Hi, this is Tiffany Bonnie.
The camera.
Hi, this is Tiffany Mane, and today is November 7th, 2008, and I'll be interviewing Mr. Charles Butler. Mr. Butler, do we have your consent to interview you today?
Yes.
Okay, and just so you know, we're going to have a consent form for you to sign at the end of the interview. So just to start off with some basic questions, where are you originally from?
Coahoma, Mississippi, this community.
Oh, you grew up here your entire life? And so, can you tell me a little bit about what it was like growing up here during your childhood?
It was pretty interesting, but yeah, it was kind of boring, not a whole lot to do. A rural community. I used to work with my father, who had a small farm. In fact, we had our own tractor and stuff, so we worked on the farm. But worked with him, and then I did some work with the Grahams. They live around the curve here, and there was a white family who I worked with, the maid, and get there in the morning about 6, and that was on some weekend when I wasn't in school, probably from about 8 to about 12, well, excuse me, about 9 to 12, and 12, 13. On weekends, get to about maybe 6:30 to 7 in the morning, from 6:30 to 7 until 12:30. And she was a busy lady. She would cook breakfast, lunch, and dinner. We would leave every day at 12:30 now. And she would wash the clothes, and we'd wash the cars, and work in the garden, and cut the yard, and iron all the clothes, and I mean, in that small time frame. But other than that, it wasn't a whole lot to do around here.
Okay, and you said you went to school. Where did you go to school?
Excuse me. Went to Hull. That's the school that was here that closed in 1977. That was a junior high school, elementary school. Then went to Aggie, which is Home Agricultural High School, for high school 8 through 12. Went to the junior college, which is now the community college, Coahoma. Went to Jackson State University in Jackson. Got a bachelor's in criminal justice, and left there. Worked a little while at the police department, and left there and went to the prison at Parchman. While there, worked on got a master's in counseling, and while doing that, somewhere in there, did a little time in the Army, and then after that, I worked at the community college, and then the rest of the time, primarily in Air Force Reserve, which was down in Pearl, Mississippi, so that was pretty much it. Did a lot of moonlight and a lot of other little jobs. Became an EMT, worked for the Ambulance Service a while. During the summers, I worked for this farmer, David Mullins. Even when I was working on my master's, I came back and did some work. And did that, worked a little while at the library at Delta State. That work down that farm was very interesting because what happened, it was a pilot project that this farmer was doing. He mentioned to me and approached me about, because he was aware of me and aware of the things that I had done, and I always ripped and run, I'd always worked hard and this and that and so forth. But he wanted to do a pilot program. Whereas he mentioned that he had observed with a lot of African Americans who had really struggled, they seemed to have had a resolve to succeed and so forth. And he thought that those struggles and things like that with hard work and work ethics created something in them that was was valuable in regards to succeeding in life. Well, he expressed a significant concern that many of his friends, kind of well off and wealthy white farmers, et cetera, bankers, et cetera, et cetera, they, as he expressed, they would be left the farms and things like that and large sums of money, and they would just squander it away. So he wanted to put something in place to try to teach them work ethic. And he explained, there's a concept now. I think there was an email that was floating around some of everywhere after the election of Barack Obama. I don't know if y'all seen the email. Have you, the email, and somebody that worked, a friend of mine showed it to me, that all whites are to report to the cat field for orientation. And it, I don't know if it's sort of a joke or whatever, but for the problem with a lot of people that do not realize in this area now, most of the people you see in the cat fields are a lot to real whites. David Butler was one of the first persons who started that in this area. And while he was met with so much resistance, so much, because I saw a lot of the kids, they used to hang around the country club and stuff all day, and no, they don't want to go in the Catfield. But, you know, I don't know how I got on that, so far up on that tangent. Where am I supposed to be?
No, it's okay. You know,
sure.
Wherever you want to go, that's where we'll go. So you talked about this pilot program. What did that pilot program consist of?
Well, it basically consisted of teenage white, the youth would, basically Chuck Cat.
Mm-hmm.
And he may have had one black out there, the person who lived on his plantation. But other than that, the rest of the persons out there were white. And I was pretty much hired to supervise him.
Hmm.
And it was an interesting experience. Yeah.
Interesting.
But they were very, a lot of them were pretty cool and nice about it. Okay. A few of them were very angry, not with me, because we got along great. But they were angry at him because he really changed their lifestyle during the summers, because as I mentioned earlier, they would hang out and party and go to the country clubs and things like that and, you know, relax all day. But now they had to go to the cabin field. And today, you see, most cabin fields, you know, if you were here during the summer, you would not see a lot of African Americans. I think you would see most whites.
Why do you think that is?
Well, first of all, you know, it gives some income during the summer, as well as if it's the case, which was a plan from Mr. David Mullins, is to teach them work ethics and so forth,
mm-hmm.
and responsibility, et cetera.
Okay.
Discipline.
Okay. And so you mentioned all of your schooling.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to know, did you go to a segregated school, or did you go to school after it was integrated here in the South?
It was integrated.
Okay. And what was that like for you? Did you observe any racial tensions, or were there any issues with that?
Not a whole lot. I'm 44. I did not get a chance to really, especially out in the rural areas. It was a little different in Clarksdale, you know, but out here in the country, rural parts of the Delta, that, in fact, there were not many whites, you know, the blacks lived inside of the small municipality, and the few whites that were here, they attended to private school in Clarksdale. So yes, as I think about it more, it was probably great segregation, the more I think about it, yes. But no, with the few whites that were here, there wasn't any interaction, no.
So what you're saying is that there was still segregation even after segregation ended?
The more I think about it, absolutely, yes, without a doubt. The more I think about it, yes,
Okay, and what was the difference between here and Clarksdale? How was Clarksdale different as far as, like, integration in schools?
Well, you had the public school systems and the private school system there, whereas here in Columbia, you only had one school, which was called, you had very few whites. So you only had the one school, so you really, you know, and a few whites are on the outskirts of the community, and that's about, they commuted, and the parents took their kids to Clarksdale, the private school was in Clarksdale. The schools were pretty much Clarksdale High and Coloma County, you know, they were kind of segregated pretty much.
Interesting. And so you mentioned going to Coloma Community College. What was that like for you? What was it like back then? Is it different from what it is now?
Yes, because the community college, which was a junior college then, there were not a lot of whites going. There are not a lot going now, but there are a lot more going now than when I was going. And then, I guess it was the school did not have a lot of things in place. The infrastructure was not in place to really market the positive things that were going on at the community college. Right now, you have a full-time PR person that was at the luncheon today. Mm-hmm. To market a lot of the good things that were going on. So basically, it was word of mouth. Primarily, you hear, you know, talk primarily in the white communities about how terrible the community college was, and which there's some people that were there last week there in the gallery, the room that we had our lunch in today. Some white ladies, I think, from the United Methodist Church, whatever we mentioned, and that's what we were talking at the dinner table, that had never even been to the college as of this past week. I mean, they had never, somehow they were shocked and amazed at this thing, place, that day, place. And it's my understanding that has always been an institution that had high standards in regards to academic classes, courses, etc. It's just that, you know, had not been marketed as such. But it then as well as now, because I recall when I went years ago, I think I was very well prepared for senior college, because I remember going to Jackson State University in Jackson. When I went to all my classes, I was pretty much ahead in most cases of the other students. And not because I was so smart or so sharp, but I think it was preparation I received from the community college.
Hmm.
I had some sharp teachers. They were. I can still hear my literature teacher talking about, and I can see it so vividly. I can just like yesterday, as though it happened. And I was standing there when Horatio was talking to Hamlet about leaving, and they and York's skull and all that. That's how. I mean, she. It was like she. You know, she was on stage of some type. Broadway play or something, but she was so detailed and in-depth. But anyway, that's just, but all of them were like
just
that.
Just an example of
the biology teacher was so sharp. I mean, wow, the government, when of course, human events, they put in there, one people deserve food, blah, 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 blah. You have to, you know, I mean, they challenge you so, and you don't forget that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, more problem.
Do you feel like the education that's being provided today at the community college prepares the students for, I guess, quote-unquote, real life?
I would say so, yes. We've got some good, and not because I work there, but right now, an example, I can give one of 50, you know, and working in counseling service, I kind of get a chance to look at the numbers and things like that. As an example, the LPN program, every student has gone to state board within the last year. Take their national exam for a licensure and certification, etc., has passed. You know, something 100% state board passing rate. That's good. That's really good. And there I can just go on with a lot of other statistics to illustrate the quality of the programs that are offered there.
Okay. And you currently work at the college, right?
I do.
What's your position?
I'm a counselor.
Okay, and what does that entail you doing at the college?
Well, it's all kind of stuff. I don't know what
happened. It's okay.
Okay, please forgive me.
It's okay. So,
I've only been doing that for about since July.
You've only been there since July?
No, I've been there about 19 years. I've been
a counselor. Okay.
As a counselor. In fact, when I first started in 89, I was a counselor. Did that for about maybe 10 years, something like that. Then a position came over, work-based learning, which was basically job placement, probability skill, helping students find jobs, work readiness, activities, etc. Then the assistant, the person who used to be the counselor, she moved in an assistant dean's position. The counselor position came open again, and so I missed it. I loved it. I enjoyed it, and with working with students and planning programs, projects. In fact, the orientation class is offered where every student has to go to. There's a program that I set up. I research other orientation programs from schools across the country, as well as the mentoring programs. So I love setting up programs and projects. That's why I've been putting that activity on today, and from that, I'm hoping that maybe service learning initiatives and other things will unfold from that, but I love stuff like that. But the division has grown so much with programs, but especially short-term programs, which there's a lot of testing, interest requirement testing and so forth, and I spent so much time testing that I'm not really doing the work that I used to do years ago in regards to programs and things like that and interacting with the students. So that's the job entails a lot of psychometric work, which is okay, but I like, man, I'm still in trouble. Wow.
It's okay. So you mentioned this testing. Can you explain that a little further?
Sure.
I'm not sure I understand.
I'll fill that out. Basically, to enroll in one of career technical programs, you have to meet minimum requirements in regards to assessment requirements in there. Mention the basic skills, in most cases, basic skills, assessment instrument, and then, you know, you mention the book, blah, 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 you know, all of that. And I said pretty much how much they pass, and you know, no gain admissions. As well as once they get in, and you assess academic gain after one semester or so long, you get the same instrument to see what conferences may have been mastered, etc. Mm-hmm. You do learn, do a lot of different tests, you do learn styles. I wish I was about to minister some today, but Ms. Robinson and Ms. Clark said, oh, it takes so long, but I enjoy those assessment instruments, personality instruments, value preference instruments, to ascertain what values the person may have. Just all type of assessment, personality, things like that.
So you said that you think that's limiting you in what you can do?
No, I don't think it's limiting me in what I can do. I think it's limiting me in what I really enjoy doing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I enjoy programs and projects, putting projects together, and the interaction piece with the students. I like those assessment instruments that are maybe the personality instruments and the students finding out about themselves and those things in which I have more interaction, more dialogue, and so forth, but not those that, you know, you just sit there and get quiet, and 3 hours you're sitting there and the only thing you mm-hmm. tell is time up and think, oh, I don't like those, no.
Okay.
I don't know.
Okay, so just to shift back a little bit,
sure.
What was your family life like growing up here in home?
The table is is about 70 years old. No, about 60 years old. I'm 44 and had about 20 years. My father had it built. And we always, and that's why I mentioned the Lord sometimes, because sometimes we may not eat together and she may eat back there sometimes. And a lot of times we come here and we always have our family meeting here. Now that's something that we enjoy. I enjoy going with that. Because I think it's critical. But it was something that my parents taught me. My mother made cakes. There's something a lot of the elder people talk about that now, that and she cooked meals every day. And my father was he was a hard-working guy. He was real hard-working, stayed on the go. And we were pretty close. And then my brothers and stuff, we're still very close. Most of the time we meet and greet each other. We Always do. Everybody's compulsive now.
I ain't no partner.
But he met Austin last night, and the night before, maybe 2 or 3 days ago. He's a little different from all the other brothers. He's very different. But other than that, with the brothers and sisters, we've always been very close. And to this day, we are still very close.
Interesting. So were your parents involved in the civil rights movement at all?
I think my father was. My mother, not a whole lot. She worked for a Home Opportunity once, and that was in 64. She worked there for quite a few years. I'm not saying, I don't think she started in 64, but that organization did a lot. And
how was she involved?
She taught kindergarten.
She taught what?
It was a kindergarten class, a history class.
Okay.
Well.
Mm-hmm. So how was your father involved in the civil rights movement?
He would, I hear Mazzano was going to talk about some of the things that he would do. Specifically, I don't know if he did a lot of marching and things like that. I know that out the church that I attended years ago, I heard my brother and others mention that when the blacks, it was not very appropriate to assemble at different places, and a lot were not comfortable assembling. The church was a place for that, and my father was always active there in the church, and I've heard comments about things like that. So
the church was really involved in?
For years and years and years, not just in this community. The church has always played a pivotal role in moving the civil rights initiative along and so forth, always.
So how did church music, become a big part of the civil rights? Was it a big part?
Absolutely, without a doubt. Music itself, as in the presentation today, it plays a force. It's a driving force. Plays a significant role in creating a certain mindset so that individuals may be more prepared or more willing to or more hype or their adrenaline and endorphins that music seems to cause that process to accelerate, I heard a minister mention he mentioned that music like in the church it pierces the soul so that once it's pierced, you can insert teaching principles, things like that. And that analogy was probably different from many that I've heard. So what the music did is once you were pierced by the music, or you were soft enough or in a certain frame of mind, such as mentioned able to dance and things like that. Once you're in a certain, same in the military, you would run, maybe get tiredness, but you'd be singing those cadences and so forth. And I mean, so the songs while you're running, and the capacity for you to maybe go longer, go farther, is probably greater because of the onset of the music that tends to stimulate the body and mind
You mentioned that your mother worked for Home Opportunities.
Right.
So do you know anything about Home Opportunities?
Sure, I served on the board for some years. And
you what?
Served on the board of directors.
Oh, you served
for some
on the board of directors.
I think it's a great organization. It's an organization that touches and plays a role and provides services to practically every facet of lives in regards to support services for communities and so forth, whether it be water organizations, whether it be training, whether it be RSVP, retired senior volunteer program, whether it be program service and activities for the seniors, whether it be summer feeding for kids. I mean, it just It is an organization which does a lot for a lot of people and does program services and activities.
Do you know anything about the Head Start program and maybe the impact that it has had in the community over the years?
Yes, without a doubt. It basically has done what the name says. It gives a head start, whereas a lot of the smaller the kids of the Head Start age would not have traditionally probably have been able to. And I know a lot of the kids and parents, in this community, I said, the income level and the amount of resources they have to educate their kids, that without that opportunity, the kids would probably, in all probability, not go to school. A lot of people would not be able to, they would be lacking in, they give assistance in regards to utilities. There's just so much that would not be there had it not been for the Head Start Initiative.
And you mentioned poverty, so is there a large amount of poverty here in Coahoma? In Coahoma County?
I would say yes, Coahoma County and all the surrounding counties. Even Tunica, some years ago, Jesse Jackson came in, and there was a ditch in the area of Tunica, which there was raw sewage running in, termed it Sugar Ditch. And we're still in an environment, an area in which our poverty is alive and well.
Do you think
poverty, academic, excuse me, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to ask you if you thought that maybe some of the poverty that exists today is sort of a legacy of maybe slavery, for instance.
Yes, a legacy of somewhat systemic poverty that has been perpetuated because of a disparity between funds, resources, etc. To this day, some of the black universities, Jackson State, Auburn State University, Mississippi Valley State, there's been some litigation, etc. The Ayers case, I think Jake Ayers went to Jackson State, you may have heard about it already. He filed a lawsuit and mentioned that the African American universities were disproportionately funded, and that started years ago. And because of monies that white schools would get, black schools not getting, blacks are slowly starting to get money so that you can have maybe labs to do this and things to do to that. As a result, the African-American universities are playing catch-up. So as for years and years and years of that disproportionate funding because of segregation and so forth, African-American students were not afforded the same opportunity to have the same resources so that they can be as academically prepped, academically able to play on a level, participate on a level playing field.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so, do you think that the situation has changed somewhat? Do you think that kids are getting better education now than they were before? Have things improved?
I think that things have improved to some degree, to a large degree, yes. But in a game of playing catch up, still African American institutions are still behind. If you look at the funding formula for the state of Mississippi, you will see where some white schools get excessively larger amounts of monies, much more so than African American universities. But the argument is now we have so many more programs, we have so many more offerings, so we need a larger budget. Well, yes, you do need a larger budget, so we're constantly giving you more, and that's the justification to give the African American institution, university, less. So that perpetual cycle is continuing on, and it's going to be difficult. But a lot of strides have been made to give additional funds to most black institutions, but it's a slow burn.
One of the things that's present in, I guess, elementary school education is No Child Left Behind Act. Do you know what that's about? Do you know anything about it?
To some degree, being on the secondary level, I do not know a lot about it. I've heard, and then some of the means and so forth, that some of the standards, vastly impacts those school districts, those institutions that may not have adequate funds and resources to fully implement the initiative. Mm-hmm. Okay. But yet they are held to the same standard of accountability.
So is that something that you see within secondary education and higher education, the accountability aspect? Is that something that's present?
Yes.
Accountability, is it something that you that's present or that's sort of stressed within higher education? Specifically in Oklahoma, is it?
Well,
is there something of a form like a test to prove?
Yes. Accountability is a big piece now in secondary and post-secondary institutions because so many schools and a lot of our kids are struggling to be able to meet and compete with those recently imposed academic standards. As a result of those students not being able to master various competencies, you see a lot of them who are not moving forward in grade levels, et cetera, ending up same grade. I've been observing so much in elementary schools as well as same grade in high schools, and recently I've been observing a lot of students who have been coming to the college to make an effort. They have been trying to get in the GD program because they stayed in the same grade level, not being able to cut it. And so they attract them over to the college and some of those GD programs. And for those who may not have the parents that may not have the educational savviness or commitment to resources to really work with their kids and supporting them and guiding them and nurturing them. Those kids, I see situations where they end up on the railroad tracks, on the street corners. So it's having a devastating impact on the communities. I mean, it's overwhelming, and it's probably getting a lot worse faster than it's getting better.
How do you think we can sort of reform our education system so that it caters to these students who can't necessarily move forward because of so many outside factors that they're dealing with?
That's a very good question. I think there may be a vast array of interventions which can be considered. I think some interventions would probably need to start at the early secondary level. Because many times, if you try to intervene at high school, junior college level, things like that, if you have a student that can't read, it's going to be difficult to assist them do much of anything. Because I've seen that with some of the assessment and so forth. But you want to help and you want to assist with this, and you can work with them, work with them, work with them, work with them. On passing the test, but especially for those that can't read, if for some reason they may be able to ease through and get in the program, they can't hack it in the program because they do not have those basic skills, reading, etc. But anyway, starting at the secondary level, I think those standards of accountability need to be in place, but I think there's a significant need and a stronger support service system to focus on those students who may have language barriers, those students who may have speaking barriers, those students who may have barriers in regards to, now this part of the assessment is great. I love this part of the assessment. There are some students who may be auditory learners, visual learners, kinesthetic, tactile, and all those. And just that's just a small example. There are hundreds of things that can be done. More assessments, more support services in response to deficiencies, whether they be basic skills or other deficiencies.
Okay. And so, what was your experience like in higher education? You said that you were well prepared at Coahoma County. After you left Coahoma County and went to Jackson, what was that like for you? Do you feel that it prepared you for your future career?
Yes, absolutely, without a doubt. I think it did. I think it did. Jackson was an interesting community. It was part of the school, part of the town, part of the environment, part of the city. And I had a lot of friends who probably, there were some people who were there when I went there, and when I left, they were still in school because of, it was in the heart of Jackson, and in the area that it was in kind of a rundown area all around. But since then, there's been a big urban renewal, but during that time, this end, that end, drugs all around, everything you can imagine. So it caused me personally to learn to make decisions, to try to make good decisions in regards to what I wanted to do in spite of the peer pressure. I never stayed a day on campus the first night I got to Jackson. I had a brother down there, and had some friends down there, and I know you're not going to go to that old dorm. You can stay and on the block where he lived, and some of our other old friends. It was just part of the city. And he and us, all the other guys, they worked at Poor Folks and a couple other restaurants there, and every night after that. They got out of work, the entire party came to our house, and it was something. It was something. But it was a great experience. It was a great experience, and it, like I said, caused me to be able to learn to say no, to be able to learn to say, this is what I'm going to do, because like I said, it was just all around, it was something. So anyway, I think I learned to have a will, strong will, strong resolve to be committed to make decisions that were in the best of my best interests, regardless of what was going on.
Okay. And so you mentioned sort of drugs and all of these things that could have affected you if you decided to do them. Do you think that that's something that you're facing now? Here at
I know it's all around between the drugs and the gangster rap music that, back to the music, you know, they get wired on all these drugs and all this music to tell them to go out and heal and shit. A lot of times I love all music. There's no music that I do. I mean, I'm from country to, I love rap music. I love gospel music out there. Oh, I don't have many of these. I mean, anything that comes on, I get so excited. I don't care what it is. but I'll listen to that music, especially rap music, and I'll say, wow, this is why they, you know, it goes back to getting hyped and psyched, and back to those endorphins and things like that, the adrenaline pumping between the drugs and then beer and alcohol and so forth. And the mindset, that frame of mind with the music, you know, and they just, I think it has correlated significantly in the to the increase in violence within the African-American community. I feel certain beyond a doubt, and those drugs play a unique role. I just smoked marijuana tons of. Oh, man. My brother, roommate, is that okay, I'm going to take it.
Oh, yeah.
Whatever you
want
to say.
He's got a cigar box full of it, yeah. Oh, yeah. And he just, I mean, he's had a pipe he smoked in. And so I got involved in it a little while, but in fact, I wrote a paper on it when I was, you know, when in my instructor, Alma Lader, she stole my work. But I wrote a paper on the effects of marijuana, dissonance versus consonance. And as I put in the paper, I wrote one paper on the subject, on the influence of marijuana. And I wrote another one on the same subject, without being under influence. And basically, I remember the consonants, there's a difference. It did a lot in regards to what you say and what you do. It widened that, and I don't remember all the details of it, but it had a lot to do with consonants and dissonance, with creating a larger gap between what you say and want to do versus what you actually do in that distorted frame of mind. Hmm. Sure.
Interesting. And so you brought up rap music, and I was wondering if you saw any similarities between rap and gospel and blues. Because you said that
yes. They all do basically the same thing. All of those forms of music inspire in some kind of way. Where it's an inspiration to commit acts of violence, where it's an inspiration to listen to gospel music and engage in acts to assist and do more for yourself, your family, your fellow man. Blues, whether it increases your feelings of being down and things like that, or identifying with being downtrodden and so forth. So it probably intensifies the association with whatever the message is. That's one thing it does. That's probably the biggest thing it does.
Going back to the youth,
sure.
Do you think the youth of today appreciates the civil rights struggle?
No, not really. I don't think so. I don't think they really identify and really understand. I don't think they do. B.B. King mentioned some years ago he's received so much better at Ole Miss. And he is at Mississippi State University.
Mm-hmm.
Those kids, they validate, and it's a report that the article that was, the interview that he did, I forget what it was on, whatever it was on, PBS, that he said he was not received. Well, now, since he's been back and maybe with the museum and all of that, more students can learn about it, maybe it's different than it was some years ago. But the kids at Ole Miss love, you know, I don't know if they identify more with that type of music or the struggles and things like that as associated with the music that he sings and performs. But no, young kids, no, they don't want to hear anything about it. It's a rare thing. It's a very rare thing.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that the youth really understands the extent to which, you know, their ancestors worked to fight for their rights? Do you think they appreciate that?
To some degree, I think they do. I think to some degree they a full appreciation, not really because not really you know, and I'm about to go back and maybe contradict myself. When I look at the election, though,
mm-hmm.
a lot of young kids, real young, you know, 12, 13, 14, 15, they are excited about President-elect Obama. And I don't know if it's because everybody else is saying, and that's Trump, that that's the person to go to, go with, or I think that's probably more so the case than I'm really identifying with just being a person who could probably change the ties relative to past oppressive situations.
So you think that the older generations have an effect on how they view the new elected president?
I think so.
Okay. I also had a question about, do you think that part of the reason why they might not appreciate it is because of the way that civil rights is taught to them? Do you think that civil rights is taught adequately throughout?
Or is it even thought, taught, period?
In education?
It's at the secondary level, there isn't a formal like you know, you get the, as I said, a history, and I hear so many people say it's his story. It's not our story, you know. But you get the history and English and all that, but not, there aren't any courses in African American studies on the secondary level to assist in really students in really understanding and getting a good grasp as to the magnitude of what transpired, our sacrifices were made, et cetera, as well as concept of their responsibility to some degree to continue to want to better themselves as well as improve the welfare of their siblings and future offspring. I feel certain that does not take place to that degree. It doesn't. Riding up to Oxford one day, I was telling a group of kids at the library. This little kid riding in the back of that Suburban, waved at me. It wasn't a wave, or I don't think a big trick, because little kid was waving with his left hand and his right hand. He was waving that rebel flag so hard. But that heritage, that tradition was implanted. You know, I mean, that commitment to and the value system of Ole Miss and things like that was something that was nurtured and continually nurtured, and the games and this and all of that. I think that there could be a room for improvement in the area of an African American community. How we're doing more than just having the Black History programs in March and February, from February, and having one day of celebration of Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday. You know, I was listening to saying Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday. Go out, don't even know, walk around your house, march somewhere, march around your house, you know. I think more needs to be done. I don't know. More needs to be done.
You brought up the rebel flag and sort of tradition.
Sure.
And so part of what we're studying is the memorialization of the civil rights movement here in Mississippi. And so we were wondering what you thought about the state flag and the controversy surrounding that.
Very, very diverse. Very mixed, I guess, feelings about that. First of all, I think all people, regardless of nationality, have certain parts of their heritage that's important to them. But in some cases, very similar thing happened to me. Two young ladies, same thing. Wasn't a rebel flag, it was about two roommates. But anyway, a lot of people are here, which is important to them. I think that if they hold on to the heritage for the good parts that allow the good aspects of their heritage to prevail in a manner which brings people together rather than divide, personally, I think it's okay. In some cases, just the sight of the flag, whatever the Americans, it causes hurt and pain and anger and things like that. I feel that African American, we should never forget and always be aware of the many atrocities that occur. But if we are really willing to rise above and make an effort to forgive and embrace the concept of trying to want to desire to work together to make the world a better place to live in some kind of way, I think that those symbols of racism and so forth should not be blocks, barriers to coming together, engaging in dialogue, engaging in process, procedures, activities that could foster climates and situations by which we can make living conditions better for all those involved.
Okay, well, I think that's all I
have.
Is there anything else you want to add?
Well, I guess, like, how do you feel about the methods being used to preserve history? Like, for instance, the museums in the area, or a place that we visited today, like the Hobson Plantation and what I'm called the Shack Up in. How do you feel about those places or those, like, avenues for preserving history?
You know, that is a part of our history, even African American. It's an undesirable part. I go back to my brother also, who I love dearly, that I have many times different ideological views as he may have. But in spite of those differences, that if I'm concerned about his welfare and all being family, I don't think it's good to just passively allow certain things, but to some degree, I don't think it's a bad thing to try. And I don't know, maybe that's a terrible example there. Let me go back to maybe with Hobson. Let me go back to it. That's a matter of whether I've got off track. That's African American heritage also. The plantations, all of that. If we can look at that heritage and that history, black and white, come together. Now, not to the point where you perpetuate that history, to the point that you want to continue to engage in oppressive behaviors. To me, that's where the line should be drawn. No tolerance should do what I have for it when it continues to be a process that continues to cause harm, promote ill will, divisiveness, and things like that. But to the point where we learn and respect each other, acknowledge that terrible and undesirable past. That's to me personally, it's okay. It's okay. I would not want the rebel flag flying above the Capitol and things like that to say that, you know, not preserve it to that degree. To me, there is this maybe specific
things for specific situations because, I don't know, I have very mixed feelings about it. To some degree, I think that it's important to allow us to have a say and be able to displace the things. And there are some, there are some positive things about everyone, although their action behaviors may have produced terrible results. I really believe that.
Is there anything else you'd like to add? Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Mm-hmm. That we haven't asked about?
I cannot.
Give me a second. Do it yourself. But he's already finished, so. How many minutes do you have left?
Five.
Oh, okay. Do you have anything else to add? Just because we don't want to waste another tape.
Well. Oh, okay.
Or if you do, we can switch the tape right now. But if not, then...
No.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I can't think of... I can't think of... But I do believe this. I know there are a lot of people who, and like I said, I know the wife have done a lot of things that are just, that have been terrible, but, and some people may feel that maybe their religious perspective and so on may not be, shouldn't be worth anything, but, I think about Dr. King, and I really believe Gandhi, Dr. King, those preachers and so forth, and we saw the power of their lives and things like that, but I believe concept that in the possibility of coming together, such as the analogy I gave about the fire and things like that, I believe that within my heart about the profound impact that engaging in certain approaches has, in addition to how effective they can be, as well as I do believe that, Dr. King mentioned that. He was trying to explain to his daughter. Did we talk about this other man? I don't know. Did I mention that? But he was trying to explain to his daughter she's wanting to go to a fun town, fun land somewhere. And we talked about this. Okay, but anyway, did we? Okay. But anyway, he was trying to explain to her, but he with him being the person he was, he didn't want to say anything bad about whites. He did not. But he was trying to explain, he said, now, sweetheart, I'll share this with you. There are some people out there that do not want you to go to fun town. Because of color of your skin. We talked about it, right? Okay. And he said, but not all people are not like that. I believe that it's critically important. I think that this thing can change it. I'm not saying be naive to what has happened. I'm not saying downplay those terrible, terrible atrocities. I'm saying that such as Nixon said when he was getting ready to get on his Air Force II helicopter. And he made a statement, something to the effect of, maybe not even get on Air Force II, but he made a statement about if you allow others who, some people say, wow, Nixon will be used, but he hasn't been close to others to control who you are, then you lose. Become as they are. This line of thinking, I feel strongly about that because if you allow yourself to become hateful and prejudiced, then you lose. You lose because you're just as bad as those who you harbor such strong, passionate feelings about that you say were wrong and wrong. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And for people, and I think that, and
I'm
think
sorry,
it's,
Mr. Butler, mm-hmm. to cut you off, but I just need to switch the tape. Because I have another question for you. So. Sorry, we just had a minute left.
Oh, no problem whatsoever. Sure.
These tapes are so short.
Weren't the other ones longer?
Yeah, but still, it's shorter because we, most interviews last for more than an hour. Okay, continue.
But I think my reference was that if you allow yourself to become consumed with hate and rage, even if it may merit having justifiable bad feelings of discomfort, I think when it goes to the point of the assimilation of taking on the same anger, the same rage, engaging in the same discriminatory practices and behaviors as the oppressors and or the wrongdoers, then I think that's true. And I personally, for one, sometimes I don't fit in the norm of a lot of African Americans around here who want to kill all the whites. You know, I don't think that's it. I think the approach show. You know, we all live on this planet. We all live in this community, in this county, in the state, United States, etc. I think it's worth the efforts to try to live together in peace and harmony.
Now that you mentioned, you know, that in South Africa they actually had something called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Mm-hmm. Which basically was a way of restorative justice.
Sure.
Basically making sure that whites and blacks in South Africa could unite and coexist
in
harmony. And so what they did was give amnesty to the Afrikaners, mm-hmm. and actually anyone in general, black or white, who committed atrocious acts during apartheid.
Sure.
And what they had to do was publicly ask for forgiveness and accept what they did, and then the person who they hurt or the people who were affected by what they did would accept their apology or not.
Sure.
And so it was a way of sort of getting, you know, the entire South African community in consensus and sort of into a feeling of, let's try to unite. So you think that would work in Mississippi?
I think it's worth to try. I really do. I have great regard for the approach engaged in dialogue along the lines of compromise, forgiveness, things like that. Absolutely. I really strongly believe in that approach.
Mm-hmm. And I guess to follow that question, do you think that it would work? Do you think that if it does, you know, come about, the state or even the country decides to try to bring this about, do you think that it could possibly have an effect on race relations? Would it be successful? Yeah.
It all depends on the definition of success.
Mm.
I think that it could have a positive impact to varying degrees.
I think that's all I have for you.
I
can't think of anything else at this point.
Okay. Well, like I said, we have a consent form for you to sign. And thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
I think you'll be answering.